BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to This Cultural Life, the series in which leading creative figures reveal the most important influences and experiences that have inspired their own work. I'm John Wilson, and my guest in this episode is the author Penelope Lively, now 89 years old. She's written more than 30 books for children, 6 short story collections, and 17 novels. Shortlisted 3 times for the Booker Prize, she won it in 1987 for her time-shifting novel, Moon Tiger, in which a terminally ill woman looks back at wartime adventures, love affairs, and fraught family life. Dame Penelope Lively has won the Carnegie Medal and the Whitbread Award for her children's books. She's also the author of 3 memoirs. Okay, phone's off.
How tech-savvy are you?
Not very, but I'm not bad for my age, actually. To some extent, I depend on granddaughters, but I can manage a phone and an iPad and so forth. When a granddaughter wanted a vintage typewriter, and the point came when the ribbon needed to be changed, nobody could see how to do it. And so I was summoned, and she was saying, I can't believe we've gone to Granny for technical advice.
Penelope Lively, welcome to This Cultural Life.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. You were born in the 1930s in Cairo, in Egypt, to British parents. What sort of childhood was it?
We lived in interesting times, I now realise, because, of course, the war came. I would have been six, seven when the war broke out. And so my sort of conscious childhood was spent against the backdrop of the war, and particularly the Libyan campaign, with Rommel's armies moving towards Egypt. But, of course, a child simply accepts the given circumstances. So it never seemed to me at all odd or unusual that the grown-ups were talking about the war all the time. And indeed, we had a map of the Libyan campaign, and we moved stickers around to show how the armies were going backwards and forwards, and all this seemed perfectly normal to me.
What had led your parents to Cairo in the first place?
Unemployment. My father was one of that generation of young men, young professional men, for whom actually there was unemployment just as there was for everyone else. And he'd, like many of them, went overseas. Lots of them went to India, Indian civil service and that kind of thing. And my father got a job with the National Bank of Egypt as, I think he was principal secretary to the governor or something. He was very young at the time. My mother joined him, and that's how I got born there.
And what sort of education did you get at an early age in Cairo?
Home education entirely. I never went to any sort of school, but the person who was looking after me, she had been a nanny. She kind of turned herself into a governess. She was wonderful. She herself had left school at 15, and she discovered a sort of do-it-yourself home education kit. It was called the Parents National Educational Union, whereby the books and the timetables were sent out, and you then applied them, as it were. So between us, we worked through this, and it was excellent, actually. The whole ethos of it was entirely about reading. The child was read to and then had to tell back the story, and then the child read the story itself and wrote back the story in its own words, and this kind of thing. And it was perfect. So when I eventually did get to an appalling boarding school in England when I was 12, I was perfectly well up in everything except science. We were sadly backward in science. We had a book called Eyes and No Eyes by Arabella Buckley, which had been published in 1890, and it was all about the flora and fauna of the English pond and stream. So with this, we went out with a net and a bucket, and I fished out things from our Nile-fed ponds and ditches, and then tried to identify the rather monstrous catch. So we were backward in that, and we weren't that good at maths either. I'm afraid algebra had poor Lucy running for cover, so we rather gave up on that.
The first cultural influence that you've chosen for this programme comes from this period of your life. You've chosen Andrew Lang's Tales of Troy and Greece. What did you love about this?
Story, the narrative of it. And of course, there was a particular fascination, which was that I was in there anyway. Penelope, my name was there, therefore it must be something to do with me, the solipsism of the 10-year-old mind. The only problem was that I was in there with the wrong part. I should have been Helen, who is beautiful, whereas Penelope is described as wise and good, which were qualities that didn't appeal. But I loved it. I was absolutely absorbed in all that mythology. I used to read it again and again. And when I go back to it, I can kind of see why. I mean, it's an old-fashioned kind of retelling of the Homeric myths, but it's still quite powerful, and I can see why, as a 10-year-old, it absolutely absorbed me.
Were you writing any stories
absolutely
at this age?
Absolutely not. Unfortunately, you know, the idea of creative writing hadn't occurred to anybody, so it was never suggested writing stories or anything. That certainly wasn't part of the PNEU syllabus.
So the Second World War was unfolding at this time when you were reading these books, the Andrew Lang tales. Was there added resonance because real battles, conflicts were taking place quite nearby?
Well, absolutely. I used to sort of retell the narratives to myself and update them, give Achilles a tank instead of that wretched sword and shield and that kind of thing, and bring the whole thing a bit more up to date.
In your mind?
Only in my mind, no writing.
That's interesting.
Isn't it? Yes, it's odd that it never occurred to anyone to say, write it down.
Were you worried about the war? How aware were you of the danger?
Do you know, I think absolutely not at all. The strange thing is that surely the adults must have been worried. I mean, it looked as though Rommel's armies would sweep into Egypt and beyond. He was on his way to the oil reserves of the Middle East. They must have been worried, but certainly it didn't spread to me. British women and children left Cairo at one point. Some went to South Africa. We went to Palestine because my mother hadn't spent a lot of time there and wanted to see more of it. And we effectively spent a rather interesting summer there. Probably the most interesting point was Jerusalem, because Lucy, who looked after me before she looked after me, she'd been looking after the family of the British High Commissioner. And so she and I were invited to stay at Government House. My mother was not. She stayed in a hotel in Jerusalem. And so there, I used to tell this story when I went to France to do publicity for books that had come out there, and I used to be able to say that I was the only surviving English woman to have seen Charles de Gaulle in his dressing gown.
And really?
Really, indeed. De Gaulle came and stayed at Government House. Presumably was engaged in discussions with the British High Commissioner. And he was staying on the same corridor that we had a bedroom on, and we were sharing a bathroom. And we were told that we must not impede the general on his way to the bathroom. So I can remember peering round the door and seeing this sort of tall, angular figure wearing a paisley dressing gown and carrying a sponge.
Did you talk to him?
Absolutely. Not. We were told that his presence there was what was called hush-hush. Mm. It was extremely hush-hush, and we must not mention it to anybody.
How interesting. So you were there, but your mother was staying elsewhere in a hotel?
Yeah, because she hadn't been invited to Government House. I think she was probably rather annoyed.
What were your parents like?
In a sense, they were rather distant. I didn't see a lot of them. My father was lovely. He was a jovial, wonderful sort of jovial presence. He was hugely gregarious. He was fun. My mother was also hugely gregarious. They were extremely social people. There were always parties and lunch parties and so forth.
In your recent memoir, Ammonites and Leaping Fish, there's a story in which you say that Rommel, part of his plan, if he'd taken Cairo, was to have made your parents' house his base or his own residence.
I know, it's extraordinary. This was actually discovered by Artemis Cooper, who wrote a book about Cairo in the war, and she found out, apparently, that Rommel, our house, had been designated as his weekend resort. He was going to have his main house in Cairo, and the weekends apparently would be spent in our house.
Well, if he had your house earmarked, it must have been a pretty grand place.
It wasn't that grand, no. I think it probably was earmarked because it was outside Cairo in what was called the cultivation in the country. Since then, it's been digested into the slums of Cairo, and indeed, it barely exists. But there were actually three houses. There were three big houses with big gardens, which had been built, I imagine, probably about 1900 or something. And they looked a bit like Southern American houses. They had green shutters and flat roofs. They were good-looking houses, but not, I wouldn't call them grand, no.
Scenes of good parties, though.
Oh, indeed, yes. Yes, certainly. There were always parties. But I was hived off into my own world in the nursery. I really didn't see much of that. And then towards the end of the war, my mother met another man, and she went off with him, and there was a divorce. So at that point, I came back to England, and my father had to sort of sort out his affairs and follow us when he could. And the poor man was by then the single father of an extremely traumatised teenager. So I've always felt very grateful to him for doing what he did for me.
You were an only child, of course.
I was indeed, yes.
Were you happy in Egypt, do you think?
I was very happy in Egypt. I was profoundly unhappy when I came to England.
Because it was such a culture shock, I guess.
It was a culture shock. I really couldn't believe it. I can remember getting off the ship and came down in a train down to London. I was going to stay with, I live with my grandmother in London. And I couldn't believe this place that was green from end to end. How could there be such a thing? I had once been to England before the war when I was six, but I didn't remember that really at all. And now here was this unbelievably cold place, unbelievably wet, unbelievably green until you got to London, which was unbelievably grey.
And you arrived in London when your parents divorced alone?
Oh, no, I came with Lucy. Lucy looked after
your governess.
Me and brought me back, and then she went out of my life. I was distraught. I mean, she was the centre of my life. So I was being shipped between my two grandmothers, my father's mother in Harley Street and my mother's mother in Somerset. Then my father's mother died, and effectively then I was looked after entirely by my Somerset grandmother.
How long was it before you saw your parents again when you arrived in London?
I saw my father pretty soon. He came back and he was having to sort his life out, get a new job and so forth. So before the end of the war, he bought a house and then we were together in that. I didn't see my mother again for, I think it was at least 2 years. She came back to England eventually with her new husband and I didn't see her until then. By which time, of course, I was somebody else. I was 12 when I came here, and I think I didn't see her again until I was 14 or 15.
The next big influence that you've chosen for this programme is an interest in archaeology, which really began, I guess, when you came to England. How did it start? What was the spark?
My first memory of this really is when I was first come, when I was 12, being taken by a family friend down to the city of London because he'd got very interested in the way that the bombing of the city had revealed the sort of skeleton outline of the Roman wall. And he took me down there and was pointing out, saying that is a Roman bastion and this is another section of the Roman wall here. And you have to imagine a landscape that's all sort of low rubble walls, a sea of willow herb in between. Quite extraordinary. This is the landscape all around St. Paul's. And I listened to him and thought, Roman? Roman? We had Romans in Egypt. How could there be Romans up here too? It somehow sparked, I think, a sort of adult interest, an adult awareness of time and space. The next time that kind of blossomed was when I was at university. And I read about how Professor Grimes was excavating the Temple of Mithras in the city.
London, in the heart of the city, near the Mansion House, an ancient Roman temple dating back to the 2nd century AD has been unearthed, the first of its kind ever discovered in the capital. A visitor to this relic of Roman habitation in London was Sir David Eccles, Minister of Works. He was shown over the site by Mr. W.F. Grimes, Director of the London Museum, who was in charge of excavations.
So I wrote to him and said, please, I was a second-year student of history and I was interested in archaeology and could I please come and help on his dig? And he wrote back the most charming letter, which I don't have, but I remember it well still, saying that unfortunately he was now up to the eyes in student volunteers and couldn't use another one. But if I wanted to keep up my interest in archaeology, to write to him later on, and he would suggest somewhere I could go to do postgraduate work on archaeology. Well, I never did. My life went off in another direction. So it was kind of, it was one of the roads not taken, which I've always felt interested in ever since. But archaeology has remained an abiding interest. An archaeologist pops up in various books, particularly in one called Treasures of Time, which was an early book and is almost entirely about an archaeologist.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that you'd grown up in Cairo, surrounded by antiquity, and yet it's arriving in London where it becomes so apparent because, I guess, of the juxtaposition with the old and the new.
You're right. It's very odd. Nobody ever talked to me enough about what I was in the middle of in ancient Egypt because, ancient Egypt is modern Egypt. It's also Napoleonic Egypt. It's Mamluk Egypt. It's all the different ages mixed up. You're seeing everything at the same time. And I just took it all for granted. We went to the pyramids every Wednesday afternoon, and I just assumed that a pyramid was a normal thing. You know, most people had them, and there they were. All I was interested in was the line of donkeys, because I was allowed to choose one donkey to have a ride on. And you inspected these wonderfully sort of dressed-up donkeys covered with tassels and so forth, all called telephone or whiskey and soda, and you chose which donkey, all their drivers competing for attention. So I was more interested in that than the pyramids themselves. And I don't remember querying it all. It was just there.
When you arrived in London at the, in the aftermath of the war, it must have been really shocking to see the ruins. A lot of kids of your age had witnessed the bombing, had been part of the Blitz, but you saw just the effect of it, didn't you?
Absolutely, yes, and that certainly hit home. I mean, I was by then quite aware of what had happened. I was aware, people talked about the Blitz all the time, so I was certainly well aware by then of what was going on.
And then you went to a British boarding school, so...
Let's pass over that.
But that was a shock to the system.
It was indeed. That was a sort of five-year calvary from which I emerged at the end.
But you were very well read when you arrived at school, from what you've told me, so that must have stood you in pretty good stead.
Not really, no. It was a very Philistine kind of school. One of the punishments was to go and spend an hour in the library reading. And in fact, there was hardly anything in the library anyway. It was a school at which games was everything. It was quite the wrong kind of school for me. Whether there would have been a right one, I don't know. It was something just to be got through. It was a very Philistine kind of school, and certainly was of no help to me at all, no.
Did you feel very different from the other children? Were you seen as an outsider?
Oh, yes, yes. I must have lacked social skills. I'd not spent nearly enough time with other children. I'd lived very much on my own. So I certainly wasn't. I didn't fit in, yes, in that sense, in any way, no.
What about the fact that your parents were divorced and not with you?
That was another thing. I mean, you have to remember that was the age in which divorce was not common. And I can remember being summoned by the headmistress and she said, your parents are divorced, Penelope. That's not very nice and I don't want you to talk about that at all.
That's appalling, isn't it? What did you think about that at the time?
Well, again, I took it for granted. At that age, you don't question. I took it for granted that, OK, if she said that, that was the way it was.
Were you a very stoic kid, or were you just having to keep it all buttoned up, do you think?
Do you know, I don't know now. I don't know. I think I may have been stoic. I sometimes wonder why I didn't sort of burst out to my father more about how much I hated the school. I mean, it may have been out of consideration for him, probably, because I knew he was having a difficult time as well. So it was a combination, I think, of stoicism and but heaven's sake, it all ended. I burst out into the bright blue air of higher education and went to university.
Did you ever consider seriously a career in archaeology?
I'd never considered any career seriously. I certainly hadn't considered a career in writing. And I have to remember, I married very young and had children very young. So all that happened. And whatever was going to happen career-wise was going to happen after that, as indeed it did.
But you studied history at Oxford, not a million miles away from archaeology, of course. So what did you expect to do? What was the life plan with that history degree? What did you expect to do with that?
A lot of particularly women, of women graduates at that time, were expected to go into teaching, I mean, you have to remember there were fewer of us, you know, at that time, the university I went to, there was one woman to 10 men. Nowadays, I think it's parity. I'm not sure there aren't even slightly more women. That's another of the sort of seismic social changes that we've seen this century. Mm. I had no particular career plan and fell into writing almost by accident. When my youngest child went to primary school, I began to think, what happens next?
And that was in your late 30s, because you'd met your husband, Jack Lively, at Oxford. You'd had the children. And was there an ambition to write? And was it just waiting to happen? Or
I don't think there was, no. I'd actually met Jack after Oxford. He'd come over from Cambridge to be a junior research fellow at St Anthony's, which is a graduate college, and I was working there as research assistant to one of the fellows. And so we met that way and married fairly soon, and then there were the children. I think for me, I'm one of those people for whom reading became writing. I was an absolutely omnivorous reader at that point, reading and reading when the children were small, which is not a good time for servicing a reading habit. But I was reading intensely all through that period, all through my late 20s. And not everybody who's a passionate reader becomes a writer, but that said, none of the writers I know have been other than passionate readers. So sometimes I think the reading kind of, you begin to wonder, you know, could I do this? Is it conceivable I could do this? And that's what happened. I'd been intensely interested in children's literature. I could see that children's literature was a unique and different kind of literature, and that there was things that could be done there that were interesting. So that was how I began, and I wrote several children's books.
You think I did it, don't you, said James. Just because most people say there aren't such things as ghosts, you have to think like they do. Simon said, there may be people who believe in poltergeists and things. Your mum and dad might. This was a thought. Perhaps he should have told his parents about Thomas Kemp right at the very beginning. After dinner, when everyone had settled down, he raised the subject. What would you say if a house suddenly began to behave in a very peculiar way? If things kind of moved and got mysteriously broken and books flew off bookshelves and bed covers jumped off beds, that kind of thing. I'd say there was a boy around, said Mrs. Harrison, aged 10 or so. James gave her a look.
And then there was an extraordinary period when I was sort of doing both, writing children's books with one hand and writing an adult novel as well. And then the children's books left me, sadly. They somehow, whatever had been there, crept away, and I knew that I couldn't do it anymore. So that was long ago. But happily, some of them are still out there.
Is this period of your life the beginning of the fascination with history and the past narratives resurfacing in the present, which has been a feature of so much of your work?
I think it is. There's a book that had a huge effect on me at that point, which is Hoskins' The Making of the English Landscape.
This is the kind of landscape a medieval peasant could easily have seen. Cultivation coming right up to the very edge of an untouched wood. Beyond the cultivated frontier, you came again into this wild country.
We were living in Oxfordshire, just outside Oxford, and I explored our local landscape, looking for lost medieval villages and this kind of thing. But I was also seeing the way in which the landscape, if you can read it, everything is happening at once. You have lost medieval field systems alongside a 20th century housing estate, alongside a 15th century church. And it seems to me that there was a kind of analogy here with the operation of memory, the way in which our own memories are in no sense linear. What we have in the head is a series of slides, so that what happened yesterday is next to something that happened 10 years ago. And any of these can pop up at any point. And that thought, that perception, has very much informed a lot of my writing. Certainly a book like Moon Tiger was, in a way, prompted by that, I think, by thoughts like that. And for me, it's very much the way in which, throughout my writing life, it's been a question of the way in which books beget books, which is what academics call intertextuality, so that something read has then prompted something written. So Hoskins made me see how the way in which this operation of memory worked. And then other books have done the same thing. Keith Thomas's wonderful history, religion, and the decline of magic actually prompted a children's book called The Ghost of Thomas Kemp. And then later on, Stephen Jay Gould's wonderful Life, which is about Cambrian fossils and paleontology, prompted a book called Cleopatra's Sister. And much, much later, sort of almost more recently, I got very interested in chaos theory. And that prompted very much a novel called How It All Began and another one called Consequences. So throughout, I've owed what I've written very much to what I've read. This has gone on all the time.
And how were you seeking out these books? What led you to some of these? Some of them quite obscure essays and theories.
Well, following up interests, certainly. I mean, I've always read a great deal of archaeology, and then archaeology led to paleontology. So it's fostering interests, but very much sort of serendipity over and over again. And I've never set out on a particular reading programme of any kind.
The theme of memory and those interweaving narratives, that is a feature, as you say, of so many of your books. Do you trace a lot of that back to that Hoskins book, The Making of the English Landscape?
Certainly a lot to that, yes. And it then developed in different ways, working out my own sort of thoughts about memory, and particularly this non-linear effect of it. But as you're quite right, yes, it's cropped up in one way or another in book after book.
A book about the English landscape, which you said was quite shocking in a way when you first arrived from Egypt. It was so very different to that arid desert landscape. How long was it before you felt Britain was your home?
I think probably about 5-6 years or so. I think all through my adolescence, I didn't really feel that I belonged here. I think I know slightly what the refugee feels like, because although I was in a country that I was native to, everybody spoke my language and I spoke the language, I didn't understand the customs. I didn't know the proprieties. I was always committing social solecisms of one kind or another. And it always just seemed alien. I was so used to the vibrant, cosmopolitan, polyglot world of Cairo, which was so utterly different, and that felt like home. And indeed, the first time I went back to it many, many, many years later, I did have this extraordinary feeling of coming home, the sights and smells. I think by the time I was in my early 20s, I'd thoroughly settled in England and definitely felt part of it, yes, and the landscape was important to me.
And what about identity, your sense of self-identity as a child in Cairo? Were you aware that you were English?
Very much so, yes. That was always drummed in, of course, by Lucy and parents. And that was puzzling. I mean, that was confusing, because here was I, English, but surrounded by all the signals of other cultures. I mean, an Islamic country, but in which there was a particularly in Cairo, a great tradition of the French, Lebanese, Greek, and so forth. So there were all sorts of identities all around, of which, you know, you were well aware you were not part of that. So it was confusing, yes. And I was very confused about this business of being English, because it was very much drummed into you that this was good. And if you looked at the map, there was brave little England up at the top, pink, and lots of pink around the rest of the world, and pink was good. I've had a lot of unlearning to do, a great deal. One of the history books, the only history book we had, was called Our Island Story, which was effectively a version of the Whig interpretation of history. It was about our island rise to greater and greater glory. And yes, I've had to do a lot of unlearning out of that book.
What do you mean unlearning, practically?
Realising that it's absolutely not the case. I probably did the unlearning during later higher education, I suppose, although one has to remember that this was a time when there was still a good deal of English-British xenophobia going on. And I remember thinking with slight horror of everything that I'd been imbibing when much younger.
Well, how big a turning point in your life was the Suez Crisis in that understanding of the world?
That's a very good question. The Suez Crisis was climactic, absolutely. It was a moment of extreme confusion for me, that, because here was my country dropping bombs on the country that I still felt like home.
100-mile international shortcut to the Far East, the Suez Canal, was run by a company with Britain as its biggest shareholder. Now Egypt's President Nasser has made his grab. He calls it nationalisation. And, cheered on as usual by an hysterical mob, he insults Britain, who duly withdrew...
We cannot agree that an act of plunder which threatens the livelihood of many nations should be allowed to succeed.
In the town itself, British armour effectively dealt with opposition from Egyptian forces who'd been ordered to continue fighting.
The Prime Minister says it was to safeguard the canal and the free passage through it. What has happened to the canal? It's blocked because of what we have done. Was the canal indeed ever really menaced before we began bombing? I very much doubt it.
I say to the British government, there is only one way in which they can even begin to restore their tarnished reputation. And that is to get out, get out, get out!
The world waits tensely to see whether the British flag will fly once more over Suez. It must go.
Opinion was polarised in this country. People were violently opposed to each other, and I was in Oxford then, working for the Fellows and Antonys, and I was going out with Jack, my husband, and academics, almost to a man and woman, were furiously anti-Eden. So Jack was actually organising a big meeting to sort of corral academic opinion in Oxford and send a letter to the Times, which was what people did in those days. And so, yes, I can remember feeling very strongly about it, that this was wrong. And for the first time, you know, having strong political opinions, yes.
So it did ferment that interest in politics. Was it also very obvious that this was a kind of end of an era, an end of that sort of British dominance in the world, that this was quite a symbolic moment?
I don't know that I realised that at the time. I realise that now. But yes, it certainly was. And also, people felt strongly about it, for and against. I mean, I may be wrong, but I think on the whole there was more against, and particularly amongst young people. But it brought out political feelings where there hadn't been before, I'm sure.
You've chosen Egypt itself as one of your big influence, and it's not a surprise. It's the backdrop to your most famous work, Moon Tiger, which won the Booker Prize in 1987. Having left at the age of 12 years old, when did you first go back?
I went back in, it must have been the early 80s, with Jack and two friends. And we went up the Nile to Luxor. But the most important thing from my point of view that we did was we actually did find my old home. I knew that by then it had been digested into the urban sprawl of Cairo. Cairo was, I think when I'd been there, it was 1 million people. And by the time I went back, it was 14 million.
This is 40 years later, isn't it?
Exactly, yes. And all I knew was that you went west out of Cairo over a canal and a railway crossing, and it was somewhere along there. Well, imagine trying to find this in a slum. But we got a taxi and explained to the driver what was necessary. And he took us west out of Cairo, found the railway to go over and the canal. And then he was very clever. He said, I'm going to find a cafe with some old men and see if any of them remember houses in this area that were lived in by Europeans. And so he did that and came back beaming and said, yes, there was an old man who said, yes, indeed. And he thought one of them was still there down that way. So by then we had to get out of the taxi because the roads were all sort of rubble strewn and we had to walk. And by then we'd acquired a sort of Pied Piper following of interested followers to whom it had been explained what all this was about. Eventually we arrived at a mosque, a new mosque, and then next door to it, sure enough, was my house. Surviving, it was called a technical college. It seemed to be a place where boys learned how to mend bicycles, and we couldn't go into it. It was closed because it was lunchtime. And of course the garden, my mother's lovely garden, completely vanished. But there it was. So it was an extraordinary sort of Rip Van Winkle feeling coming
Amazing.
Back.
A and it flood was, of memories, I presume.
And it was wonderful because all our followers, everybody was shaking hands and smiling and congratulating me. It was wonderful.
How did that lead to the writing, or how did it influence the themes that you explored in Moon Tiger?
I'd always thought, hoped that I'd write in some way that could reflect, that could use my childhood experience. But until we went there, I couldn't see any way to do it. Once I'd been there and had in my head again the way it looked, the way it smelt, the way it felt, I knew then that I could do it. I don't think I could have written the book without that visit.
I have seen Cairo since the war years. The place didn't look the same, but it felt the same. Sensations clutched and transformed me. I stood outside some concrete and plate glass tower block, picked a handful of eucalyptus leaves from a branch, crushed them in my hand, smelt, and tears came to my eyes. 67-year-old Claudia, on a pavement awash with packaged American matrons, crying not in grief, but in wonder that nothing is ever lost, that everything can be retrieved, that a lifetime is not linear, but instant, that inside the head, everything happens at once.
It's rooted in Cairo, in a way, or that was the starting point, but it's an extraordinary story, told at the end of her life from the point of view of Claudia Hampton, famous writer, and she's looking back and we get the series of interweaving memories and relationships with her brother Gordon and the father of her child Jasper, and most importantly, I guess, Tom, the one-time lover who died in the war. Where did Claudia come from?
Do you know, I'm not sure now. Remember, it's a long time ago since I wrote that book. And I probably at the time I could have answered that question more sensibly. But I don't think there was any sort of role model or some person that I took her for. She arrived somehow.
She's an incredibly complex character, isn't she? So full of life, incredibly attractive, contradictory in many ways, and not a very good mother.
No.
Were you tapping into your own childhood experiences there, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think more, I was often asked in the aftermath of writing the book whether she was in any way based on me. And the answer to that is absolutely not. sometimes I wish, yes. But I don't know that I like her. There was a lot of comment in the wake of the book about people's reactions to Claudia. Interestingly, more often women liked her than men. Men, I think, seem to be alarmed by her.
It is a love story, but it's a book also about ageing and memory. How is your own personal experience of ageing matched up to the way that you imagined it when you were writing Moon Tiger?
Well, I look at that book with some criticism now because, yes, when I wrote it, I was in my 50s, I suppose, and Claudia is the narrator, and she's dying. She's in her, 70s, I think. And, of course, I didn't know about that. I think if I had, I might have written her, that part of her, a bit differently. I might have made her old age presence a bit more striking than it is. Because, yes, I know more now. When I hit 80, which actually seems quite a long time ago now, I thought that it might be interesting to look at the view from 80, to look at what it's like to be in this new demographic, because it is a new demographic. In the Western world, there are now enough people in their 80s to keep the Department of Work and Pensions in a state of anxiety. And it's rather interesting to be there, because one of the things that you can do, and one of the things that I was trying to do in a book called Ammonites and Leaping Fish, was look back at the part of the 20th century that I've lived through, trying to look at how things had seemed at the time and how they looked at with the wisdoms of hindsight, with the ways in which historians now commentate, what it had been like to live through the 9 days of the Cuba crisis, which I remember vividly. I can remember I had 2 small children then, and I remember looking at these children and thinking, I don't think these children are going to grow up. And so it's interesting now to read about all the commentaries on the Cold War, and I've done so, and realise exactly what was going on and how we came out of it.
You have a unique perspective on the past from your age, but also you are, as you say, part of this emerging demographic, which has a sense of a new reality of being old in a way that previous generations couldn't have conceived, unless it was very often in quite a reductive way, wasn't it? Idea of what old age represented.
Yes, exactly. I think attitudes towards age may have changed. I can remember I was a judge for a while of a children's writing competition that Ted Hughes used to run. And I can remember that when children were asked to write an essay about their grandparents, and they all depicted their grandparents as walking with sticks and sitting wrapped up in shawls and so forth. Actually, for children of that age, their grandparents were people in their 60s who were probably still working. And I think that may have changed a bit. I mean, the old are more vigorous nowadays. The old are more vociferous. There are more of us. And those who are so fortunate enough to be in reasonable health are more visible, I think.
And active. I mean, we've got to point out that you've published three books in your 80s so far. Any more on the way?
No.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. No, that's it. I have. It's high time to bow out.
But you have so much to say, quite clearly, as is apparent over the course of this programme. Do you not still get that itch to sit down with a pen or open the computer?
I feel very odd without it. I certainly feel odd without it, yes. It feels odd not to be working, not to be writing something. I miss it, but I also think that it's gone. And I don't. You don't flog a dead horse. You acknowledge that and turn back to reading instead.
One of the greatest fears, of course, that we have about ageing is losing memory. And as we've discussed, memory has been so core to your work. It's been your core subject in a way. Are your memories still as vivid as they ever were?
Yes. I think what happens in old age is that actually the early memories get more vivid, and there are plenty of them. What we all suffer from is the recent memory. It's the not knowing where you put your specs, and the black hole into which names go, which is what lets us down most of all. But I don't think the general kind of harvest of memories suffers at all. It seems to me that that's all still there. But it remains as mysterious as it's ever been. Why do we have that set of memories and not a completely different set? Why do we remember those things, and some of them trivial, not particularly important, and not a whole lot of others that may have been more important? Well, that's a matter presumably for the psychoanalysts.
Penelope Lively, thank you very much indeed for sharing your cultural life.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and in my podcast, Just One Thing, I'm investigating some quick, simple, and surprising ways to improve your health and life. From eating some dark chocolate,
that was really good,
to improve your heart, to playing video games, to enhance your brain power.
Oh, dear. I'd be slaughtered, aren't I?
Or singing your favourite songs to bolster your immune system. So, to benefit your brain and body in ways you might not expect, here's just one thing you can do right now. Subscribe to the podcast on BBC Sounds.